That list of federal programs at high risk of failure, published every 2 years by the Government Accountability Office, often seems like flypaper. Once a program lands on there, it stays stuck. Yet while some programs do seem to never get off the list, in fact, there's a lot of turnover. I discussed some of the highlights with Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, head of the GAO.
We're reporting this year, Tom, solid progress in a number of areas. Actually, of the 32 areas that were on the high-risk list, 23, or about two-thirds of them, have either met or partially met all five criteria for coming off the list. Now, the five criteria are leadership development, the capacity, resources, people, have a good action plan that addresses root cause, a good monitoring effort, and actually demonstrating some results that we've reduced the risk, we've had progress. 11 of the areas have increased, causing us to increase their scoring on one of those five elements in a positive direction. So overall, I'm satisfied in those areas. There are a number of areas, though, that need substantial attention yet, and we cite those in the report. VA healthcare, DOD financial management, cybersecurity, protecting our information systems at the federal government, and also critical infrastructure protection, information technology acquisitions and operations, and the federal role in housing finance. These are some of the areas that still need attention. We also, on the progress front, took one area off the high-risk list this year. That's sharing of information on terrorist-related information. They've made steady progress over the years. Congress required information sharing environment. It's been implemented properly. And importantly, we felt it was important to take it off the list at this point. But once it's off the list, it's not necessarily out of sight. And so we keep an eye on these issues.
In many ways, none of these are really engineering or control problems. I mean, it's all about people, because that is the element of government.
Yeah, people's definitely a component. Many of the areas on the list are also on there because there are critical skill gaps. Cybersecurity being a good example, acquisition workforce and number of areas are in contract management area, petroleum engineers and oil and gas management, et cetera. So you're right. But there's also, in addition to the people, you need the leadership commitment and you need follow through and a good plan. And that's where I've seen some good progress. You know, we have been having a pattern of meeting with the agencies on the high-risk list, and the Deputy Director for Management, OMB, and the OMB team, and I personally participate in all those meetings to go over specifically what needs to be done to make progress in that area. So we've got a good forum for doing that. Also, this past year, Congress passed a law, the Program Improvement Act, that now statutorily will require OMB to do a portfolio review of any area we designate high-risk, and to establish a council to focus on the areas GAO's designated high risk. So that'll give it an additional impetus for continued improvements.
That's a pattern I guess we see from time to time, is that OMB might issue a policy about something like program improvement, and maybe they'll get a third of the way up of the hill. But when Congress weighs in with legislation on it, then they get 75% of the way up the hill.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's really not that many management improvements that have sustained action and actually produce results that do not have a legislative underpinning. I've always recommended to the Congress, you know, whether it's a Government Performance Results Act, the CFO Act, the Federal Information Technology Reform Act, this act related to program improvements. Congress also passed the Fraud Reduction and Analytics Act based on GAO's recommendations for a fraud framework. The Data Act is another example. And so all these things are really important so that they can transcend individual administrations and have focused attention from the executive branch and congressional oversight.
Also on the topic of OMB, they did something this year, which is to revise Circular A-123 that covers a lot of management areas of federal agencies. And one of the things they inculcated into that is risk management. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a term of art these days. It's something of a faddish term. Do you see risk management, as you look to develop the high-risk list, do you see risk management as something starting to really take hold in the way federal agencies go about getting past the risks?
Yes. Well, OMB this year, they focused on including enterprise risk management, which is, as you point, is sort of the modern iteration of risk management. But actually, Tom, risk management has been part of the federal internal control standards that agencies are supposed to follow since GAO first established those in 1982. So risk management has always been there, both in assessing your risk and mitigating your risk and having a good plan. Now, enterprise risk management takes it to a different level, and I think it's a good development and a good trend, but all of our areas really is focusing in on what are your risks, how do you assess them, but how do you fix them, importantly.
We're speaking with Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, and let's get to some of the ones that were added to the high-risk list this year, especially the census count. And I was surprised to see how much, in spite of all the technology they have applied to this over the years, the cost per nose count is rising.
Yes, yes. The cost for the 2010 census was $12.3 billion, which was a 31% increase from the 2000 census. So the costs have been going up. One of the main drivers and the reasons for that, Tom, is that the mail response rate, because that's the main vehicle that census has been using to try to get people to fill out its questionnaires and send them back by mail, has gone from a 78% response rate in 1970 to only a 63% response rate for the 2010 census. So it's a 15% drop, which is very significant because they have to send enumerators out door to door to try to get in touch with people. And sometimes they've sent them back several times. So it's a very labor-intensive operation. That's driving a lot of the costs. Now, this time, in order to avoid the cost, they're trying to use different innovations. Because if they didn't change the procedures, the likely estimate of the cost for the 2020 census would be over $17 billion, and it would go up even further.
And that's not just inflation. That's high per capita of the people they're counting.
That's right. I mean, we have more of a population.
But not that much more.
Not that much more. That's not driving it. It's the response rate and the manual operation. So this time they're going to try to use internet response on a wide basis, which they've never used before. They're going to try to use administrative records where the government already knows something if people don't respond and see how accurate that could be. They're trying to use geospatial technology and imagery to map the location, because it's not only important to count the people, but to count them precisely by congressional district and location as well. And they're using additional technologies that caused a problem in the last census.
Yeah, they sort of took a quick off-ramp before they got to those technologies 10 years ago.
Right, right. And they were on a high-risk list then, too.
Right.
But they're trying to use some of that new technology now as well. And all these things are potential improvements, but they introduce risk. And so we've made a lot of recommendations, about 30. Only six have been fully implemented so far.
And they're a little behind already, too.
Yeah, well, the part of it is they've had some cancel some of the tests by their accounts due to some resource limitations. The testing is really important because the field tests and the dress rehearsal type of things really have to be fully integrated, tested in the next year or two. Because after that, it's pretty well set. It's difficult to make last-minute changes.
Plus, they still have to make the form itself, and doesn't that require congressional approval, ultimately?
I'm not sure. They've cut back on the form. I mean, they're using another census vehicle, the American Count Survey, Community Survey, I think it's called, to collect a lot of information. They've cut back on the decennial quite a bit. And so that's really not the driver in this whole thing. It's really getting an integrated schedule, coming up with good cost estimates, and recruiting and training. I mean, they hire a fair amount of people, and they have to get them in, they have to hire them and get them trained, and so they're having some issues there. But I would say the census director, John Thompson, has been very cooperative and working with us, and we have a good working relationship. They have a big job, and you know, we're pointing out where they need to address things. For example, if you want to have internet response, you need information security to protect the data. And the census data is very sensitive, and there are certain laws requiring them to protect it. And so we've recommended that they focus on that area, among others.
Another area that really caught my eye was something you added, the environmental liability of the company, of the country. I remember back to the Love Canal days, which gave rise to RCRA, I think it was called. I don't even remember the acronym. But the Superfunds, and there are a lot of them that the government has pledged to clean up, a lot of military waste areas. And you would think after 30, 40, 50 years of trying, they would be a little bit further down the road there.
Well, that's the concern that we have, Tom. I mean, the liability is approaching $500 billion. I think it's likely understated at this point. Most of it relates to nuclear weapon systems, complex waste, as you point out, decades ago. But, you know, and that continues to accumulate. And we haven't done anything in the final repository for that. There's a lot of waste from DOD and their operations and cleanup as well.
Yeah, the repository is a 20-year effort, which got so caught up in politics that it has never been able to be realized.
Right, right. And the Department of Energy had recommended to the president recently they create two repositories, one for defense, one for civilian agencies. We looked at the business case. We didn't really see a good business case for that and recommended they go back to the drawing board a bit and take a look at that issue. But it's not for lack of spending money. We're spending billions of dollars every year to clean up these activities, but the liability keeps growing. And so that was what landed it on the high-risk list. And they need to have more risk-based approaches. We need to have better estimates. We need to have better plans and more visibility. When we have a recommendation outstanding from 1994 that the agencies report to the Congress how well they're achieving their objectives in these areas, and so that Congress would have better information. I'm hopeful that that now will get some attention.
And let's move to some of the ones that are perennials, if you will. And I guess maybe this is a good time to talk about DOD weapons systems acquisition, especially when the administration is talking about a big buildup of military, big spending increases. This is only going to come to the forefront.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's weapon systems acquisition is one of the charter members on the high risk list. We've seen some progress. They've put in their policies a lot of best practices that we suggest, but they're not consistently following and implementing the best practices. And so we still see, you know, while there are some pockets of improvement in some of the bigger areas, there's still cost, schedule, and delays in developing the weapon systems. And we've made some specific recommendations about overall changes they could make in their process and looking at more of a portfolio management approach. And we've also made some recommendations on specific weapon systems, like, for example, that an affordability analysis be done for the Joint Strike Fighter, that more testing be done before you proceed into more production on the littoral combat ships, just to give you a couple examples.
Yeah, those have both been pretty troubled and yet with great promise. Now, Congress last year, I think in the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, devolved some procurement authority back to the armed services and away from central DOD. What's your thought whether that will help or maybe make things more confused?
Well, you know, as far as we're concerned, you know, it's important that any change dictated by the Congress be implemented effectively. So we'll be focusing on whether or not it's being implemented effectively. There's changes over time from centralization to decentralization, not only in DOD, but in other agencies across the government. And neither one's a panacea, it depends on how well they're implemented. So our focus will be on how well DOD's implementing this and to make sure that there's enough transparency in the process and that the services do not begin duplicating one another and that there's effective coordination.
And do you also look at upstream at the requirements for some of these programs? I mean, you have an airplane. You can build an airplane, but if it has to be three different versions or the littoral combat ship is four or five ships in one made of new materials, I mean, there's a lot of complexity they're building in at the outset. And so it seems like the risk begins at the conception of some of these programs.
No, yes, you're exactly right. I mean, we've found that the requirements definition area is an area that needs a lot of attention, not only to make sure that the requirements don't duplicate other efforts that are underway, but the requirements don't keep changing as you go through the process or getting more expansive. That adds to the cost and time and complexity of the projects as well.
And moving on to the strategic human capital management item on the risk list, This idea, reforming civil service, goes back probably 15 years now. And nothing seems to quite change when it comes to personnel management and human capital.
Yeah, we've seen some progress. Congress has given agencies greater flexibilities. They don't always use the flexibilities they have available. We've seen some progress recently, particularly two examples I would give you. One is OPM issued a regulation in December 2016, right at the tail end of the administration, requiring agencies to focus more on identifying and addressing skill gaps. And this is something that we have been pushing for a number of years, not only to address existing skill gaps, but to monitor it and what skill gaps do they foresee in the future, depending on their workload. Congress also gave DOD the ability for civilian employees to use a two-year probationary period, which we found to be effective in assessing new employees. So those are two examples. It's moving in the right direction, but there's a lot of things that you need to do to focus on this. A big concern is the impending retirements going forward, changing in the nature of the federal government's business and becoming more sophisticated, cybersecurity and other areas. So we're going to keep a watchful eye on this, and hopefully we'll see greater progress.
Veterans Affairs, one of the thoughts in Congress, at least it comes up from time to time, came up a little bit more in the last couple of years, is moving a lot of their senior staff out of Title V and into Title 38, which medical personnel have already been in. And that's a profound change for people that have been used to the civil service system as we know it. Thoughts on that one, and does that come up in the thinking?
Yeah, we haven't looked at that very closely, that particular issue, Tom, recently. The reasons we put VA healthcare on the high-risk list were ambiguous policies and procedures. There was a lack of oversight and accountability, so the extent to which any of these changes that you mentioned might improve accountability would be important. IT management, their scheduling system for scheduling appointments with veterans is 30 years old. They have some 50-year-old systems. Their IT is a problem. Training of their employees is a problem. And proper resource allocations is an issue. And so they've made some progress, but there's a lot more that needs to be done there to bring that under control and give veterans the proper timely health care that they deserve.
With all the agencies having trouble modernizing their IT systems, it's a wonder you don't put COBOL code itself as an item on the high-risk list.
Yeah. Well, we put last year, last update in 2015, information technology acquisitions and operations across the entire federal government on the high-risk list. So that's that includes COBOL.
And there it remains.
That's right.
All right. And I wanted to ask you about Medicare and Medicaid, because there's really two issues there. There's the fraud, waste and abuse, improper payments in the operation of the program.
Right.
Then there's the program itself,
right,
where unlike Social Security, where you can predict what changes will have on the future spending. I mean, if anything threatens the republic, you could argue that it is the unknown actuarial costs, or even what we do know about them, of Medicare and Medicaid. So what are your high-risk list concerns there, and what are you saying Congress ought to consider?
Yes. No, you're exactly right, though. In terms of rising health care costs and growth in interest on the federal debt are what's driving what we consider to be a long-term unsustainable fiscal path for the federal government. So in the Medicare program, that's been on the list for since the beginning. We have a number of suggestions on payment policies that could be changed. For example, a lot of physicians have moved to operate out of hospitals. And so if you go for an office visit assigned with a hospital compared to an office visit somebody in a private building that they would have been before, the government reimburses more for the hospital, sort of inpatient, outpatient approach.
And the $5 aspirin places.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that to your judgment. But the government ends up paying more for the doctors that are associated with the hospital as opposed to the doctor in private practice. We think money could be saved there. There were certain cancer hospitals that were created in the 80s, but now with cancer treatments more ubiquitous, throughout the healthcare system, their special treatment doesn't really make sense anymore. We estimate you could save $500 million a year by equalizing the payments there. So we have a lot of there, and Medicare Advantage, there's risk adjustment factors compared to the Medicare fee-for-service area we think could be adjusted. Billions could be saved there. So we have a lot of recommendations about payment approaches in Medicare that could save billions of dollars. On the improper payment side, as you mentioned, which are payments that should not have been made or made in the wrong amounts, Medicare still tops the list. Last year's estimate was $60 billion in improper payments, over 10%, which is the statutory limit for defining a program out of noncompliance, according to the law. So there's a lot more that needs to be done there. Now, on Medicaid, there's obviously a lot of discussions going on now associated with the Affordable Care Act and potential revisions that could create some further changes for Medicaid. There's the managed care portion of Medicaid that is hasn't had the same degree of scrutiny and accountability it needs to have. So based on our recommendations, audits are not going to be required of the managed care portion of Medicaid, which is about approaching 40% of the total expenditures for Medicaid. Now, Medicaid improper payments were $36 billion last year, up from $29 billion. And I don't believe that's the full estimate, because that's mostly based on the fee-for-service portion of Medicaid, not the managed care portion. These audits, I believe, will reveal potentially additional problems in that area. CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Studies, has also been given a number of waivers to states to implement Medicaid programs, about a third of all the spending now. And some of those weren't, in our view, budget neutral, which was required by HHS policy. So that the whole Medicaid area requires attention. I've been working with the state audit community recently, because Medicaid in many states is 30% of the entire budget of the state. And so to try to get more attention and accountability into the Medicaid program, it's difficult to do it from a centralized level because each state has different aspects of tailoring its program.
Because at CMS, they have tried to use modern data analytics techniques and different programs to try to detect fraud and prevent fraud. But as you say, a lot of it takes place at the state level, they need to almost develop a federated approach to a fraud detection.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, they're better able at Medicare to have up-to-date data than Medicaid. Some of the data they have in Medicaid is like 2 years old, is the most recent available data. And I always...
So if you're a fraudster, that's where you'll go.
Well, there's ample opportunities for that type of activity in healthcare and other federal programs. I mean, the one thing that most people don't realize, the latest estimate from all the federal agencies combined for improper payments across the federal government was $144 billion. Now, that was...
That's about the budget of France or something.
It was... I'm not sure what it is in euros.
I'm just guessing.
Days, but yeah. It's 22 different agencies. There are dozens and dozens of federal programs. Now, the largest ones are, as I mentioned, Medicare, Medicaid, Earned Income Tax Credit. But virtually every department agency has some degree of improper payments. And this is the concern I have is that Medicare and Medicaid are the fastest growing federal programs. And if the agencies don't get better control on this issue, the numbers are going to continue to rise. It's risen for the last 3 years. And this year, 18 programs didn't even report. So the $144 billion is really... a conservative estimate. It's higher likely if these programs had also reported.
And we could not talk about the high risk list without mentioning Postal Service, again, mm-hmm. a perennial on there. And they always like to say, well, we're not a federal agency. We operate just like a business. And I always say, well, then how come you have to go to Congress every time you want to do anything, or go to the Regulatory Commission if you want to put a penny on a stamp? And so what are your thoughts on Postal Service? Congress has tried over and over, and they can't quite seem to agree on that final push to get legislation done.
Yeah. The Postal Service has taken some action to control costs, but the concern we have is they really don't have any other major cost-cutting efforts in the offing, which they really need. Comprehensive legislation is needed to address some of their structural issues. The business model is just not viable with electronic commerce these days, and so there needs to be an alignment of revenues and expenditures. A big part of the discussion has been focused on the post-retirement healthcare benefits, and need a reasonably responsible way to help the Postal Service in that area, but not shift the costs to the taxpayers as well. And so, you know, the Postal Service is kind of like, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, where you have these kind of government corporations, but they're quasi. And right now, and it's also on the high-risk list, you have Fannie and Freddie are still in federal conservatorship, and we need to have an approach to return them to a normal kind of status and either decide to move things into the private sector or, you know, make them just government agencies or something in the middle. But we need better accountability over that so they can really operate, and there's a good dialogue with the Congress about how you can you know, modify if we want to have these sort of quasi arrangements between corporate structures and government structures.
Well, if you look at Amtrak and look at Postal Service, you could say maybe that model is not optimal for moving things from point A to point B.
There are definitely risks associated with that. And for years before Fannie and Freddie, GAO had recommended additional regulatory oversight over those entities because there was an implicit federal government guarantee for a lot of their debt. And that now has turned into more than just implicit.
Now, if I read your biography correctly, you have a couple more years left in a term appointment, right?
Yes, yes. The Comptroller General position has a 15-year appointment. I started my period as a confirmed Comptroller General in December 2010. I was acting since March 2008. That doesn't count toward the 15, much to the chagrin of my wife. So my appointment goes till December 2025. So I have 8-plus years left, Tom.
So you'll be here for at least 3 or 4 more high-risk lists?
Yes.
No desire to maybe retire and then go on to somewhere where you might be able to count Oscar ballots?
No. I'm very happy with my current position. I plan to stay there and finish my term, health permitting.